Welcome to Triumphs and Tragedies. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. This is the 12th episode in 20 episodes on the history of the Catholic Church. In this episode, we're dealing with the 11th century, the years 1000 to 1100. Now, if you've been listening to the series so far, you realize that in the last two episodes, episodes 10 and 11, we've been dealing with a rather dark section, time period in the Church. During these dark ages, the papacy was really taken over by sort of mafia families in Italy, struggling for power, struggling for pleasure, struggling for the wealth of that had accumulated to the papacy. And there were some truly, genuinely evil popes during this time period, men who had forsaken the call of Christ and forsaken, had no idea at all of being a successor of Peter, but were simply involved and cared only for the power and the pleasure that went with the papacy. And also, during this time period, the Church itself had fallen into chaos and fallen into dark times. But I want to remind you also, however, that it was especially in the 10th century that the renewal of the Church began, and it began through the monastic movements. You'll remember I stressed the influence of Saint Benedict and the Benedictine monasteries. Well, in the 10th century, I would remind you, in the year 909, the monastery of Cluny was established in Burgundy in France. And the reform of Cluny was something which continued all through the 10th century, all through the 900s. And the reform consisted of an expansion of the monastic movement. By the end of the reform period, there were over 200 monasteries that were part of the Clunaic reform. And this reform really was a powerful renewal movement in the Church, going on it's kind of below the radar and at a grassroots level all across Europe in the 10th century, and it was bringing together the great accomplishments of the what would turn out to be the great accomplishments of the Benedictine movement. What were some of those accomplishments? It's important to look at this because during this the 900s and then continuing, the Benedictine monasteries had actually laid down, by God's providence, laid down a secure foundation for the development of a wonderful flowering of Christian culture. And they did this in several ways. First of all, they did it through the consolidation of community. The monasteries became little enclaves and of civilization, little enclaves of learning, of beauty, of music, of art, of architecture, of theology. The monks preserved the old books from the classical times of Greece and Rome. They collected the old books and they recopied them. We have the monks to thank for the existence and the preservation of all the great histories and the great books from Greek and Roman times. We also have them to thank for various other things that we take completely for granted. It was their scholarship which began to establish the foundation for law and jurisprudence in Europe. It was their scholarship and their education and their schools which began to establish a foundation for what would become the university system. The monks also, in their pioneering of Gregorian chant, are the ones we have to thank for musical notation. So that the music could be spread around to the different monasteries, they developed a method of musical notation, which we now is the foundation for all musical notation. And we would not have scores of music if it weren't for the Benedictine monks who established that. They also made great strides forward in theology and spirituality. So while all of this corruption was going on in the halls of the Vatican and the struggles for power were taking place there in Rome, remember, God is working behind the scenes. God is working below the radar. God's working through the renewal of the Church, through the monastic movement in this 10th century, in the 900s. And we're going to see now, as we move into the 11th century, that it bears fruit. And the 11th century is the time, right when we turn from into the end of the first millennium, we turn into a time of reform in the Church. And because the Church is the power of the papacy is tied up with the secular powers, with the kings and the emperors of the time, it's invariable that the reform of the Church is going to touch on this a very important question of power in the church, the interplay between the secular power and the spiritual power. Who's actually in charge? You might remember that right back through to Charlemagne, a relationship developed between his father Pepin and the Pope, and Pepin gave the Pope the land that he needed in Italy to claim power, and through the centuries the Pope would always anoint and crown the emperor, and the emperor returned the courtesy by getting very involved and very committed to the church and very involved in some of the decisions in the church. Well, this power play back and forth between Pope and Emperor, between Pope and King, is what we're going to see playing out now in the 11th century as the power struggles continue. There are some very dramatic scenes that take place, and these power struggles as they emerge we'll see eventually help to bring reform into the church. And so to talk about that, we need to then ask what was happening towards the end of the 900s as we move into the 11th century, into the 1000s. And you'll remember that the German kings were gaining more and more power, and the German king Otto was crowned by Pope John the 12th, and in 962. And then there was a succession of his sons and grandsons, Ottos and Henrys, as they call them, who were crowned as the emperor by the Pope, and very often then tried to appoint the Pope. And during the end of the 900s and into the first years of the 11th century, the reform movement in the church actually began to get some wheels and get into gear. And this was under the guidance of the Emperor Otto, and Otto began to appoint some popes who actually began to make a difference. However, they had a big setback. Around the middle of the century, another pope from the same, you might have remembered the Theophylact family, who had controlled the papacy with the wicked Mariozza and Alberic and so forth in the earlier centuries. This same family was resurgent around the middle of the 11th century, and another one of the very bad popes, I'm afraid, was elected, and that was Benedict the Ninth. Benedict the Ninth was elected to the papacy when he was, I think, only 20 years old. He was a layman. He hadn't been a priest. He hadn't been a bishop. And he was elected as a power play by his family. He was totally decadent. He was petulant. He was spoiled. He was given to immorality and lust and greed. And Benedict the Ninth, therefore, ranks right up there with John the 12th and some of the others from the earlier centuries we've just looked at as one of the genuinely evil and bad popes. Well, Benedict the Ninth is resisted, and thank God the people of Rome and the German king to the north, Henry the Third, are unhappy with Benedict the Ninth, and so in 1045 he's driven out of Rome, and another pope is elected, Sylvester the Third. So Sylvester the Third comes and takes the throne, but he's then driven out because Benedict the Ninth gathers some of his friends and some power, some soldiers, and marches back into Rome and pushes Sylvester the Third out. But by this time, Benedict the Ninth thinks he wants to go off and get married, so he doesn't really want to be pope anymore. So he goes to his uncle, and he basically sells the papacy to his uncle, and his uncle takes the name Gregory the Sixth. And his uncle was actually a good man who wanted to reform the papacy, and he thought that it was worth buying the papacy from Benedict so that he could do so. Benedict didn't exactly sell the papacy. He sold. He asked for a price for a pension, for an ongoing annual sort of pension or allowance from his uncle, who became Gregory the Sixth. So we now have a situation where in 1045, right in the middle of the 11th century, we've got three popes. We've got Benedict the Ninth, who's a scoundrel. We've got Sylvester the Third, who's waiting in the wings. He's been elected by the people instead of Benedict the Ninth. And then we've got Benedict the Ninth's uncle, Gregory the Sixth, who's also trying to be pope. Well, The king, Henry, the German king Henry, decides, Henry III, decides he's had enough, and he marches down into Rome, and at the Synod of Sutri in 1046, he deposes all three of those popes. And so Benedict IX is sent packing, Sylvester III is sent packing, and Gregory VI is also sent packing. And Henry III, therefore, not only sends these three popes packing, but something very important takes place. He actually chooses to have the it takes the power on himself to appoint the pope. This is going to lead later to what we call the investiture crisis. And what had been happening over the years is that as the church became more and more wealthy, to be an abbot or to be a bishop meant that you controlled vast swaths of land and therefore vast wealth. And the kings and the noblemen who had the power would therefore choose to appoint the abbots and to appoint the bishops instead of the pope appointing the bishops. Now, when the papacy was weak and it was corrupted by immature, lustful, greedy members of the Italian families, that weakened the papacy, and they were quarreling and fighting and murdering one another and poisoning one another. And so the kings took upon themselves the power of appointing the bishops and the abbots. And this power which they had, therefore, that was called the power of investiture, was a very important conflict with the papacy. And ironically enough, it was Henry III, the German king, who, when he got rid of those three popes, Benedict, Sylvester, and Gregory, was doing so that he might reform the papacy. And this reformation of the papacy, this reform of the papacy, then began to take place under Henry III. There's a description of Henry III, and that he actually saw himself as a divinely appointed king. He saw himself as a king in the mode in the model on the model of the Old Testament, and this description of him here is pretty important. He saw himself very much as a royal. He saw himself as a royal theocrat, here it is, who often dressed in the robes of a biblical high priest, ornamented with apocalyptic and zodiacal emblems to symbolize his regal priestly role. He believed himself appointed by God to take care of all the interests of his people. He chose the bishops and the popes, making sure in each case that the candidate was fit for the office. And so he's the one who came in and deposed those three popes and saw himself very much as appointed by God to clean up the church. Well, when those three popes left in the middle of the 11th century, the popes who followed them actually took very significant names, Clement II and Damasus II. Now, Clement and Damasus were the sort of third and fourth popes right at the very beginning of the church. And so by taking those names of Clement and Damasus, they saw themselves very much as getting a fresh start and making a new beginning in the church. And so they did. They began to initiate reforms in the church. They were looking carefully at the question of married priests. One of the problems with having married priests is that the priests tended to owned the property of the church, and so they would the priests and bishops who were married would leave the property to their sons, and they would ordain their sons as priests even though they had no sacred calling. So again, the secular world was involved in the church in a way which was feeding the greed and feeding the corruption of power. And so they began to address this, and after Clement and Damasus comes Leo IX. Now Leo IX was a great reformer, and backed by the king, he began to clean up the problem of simony. Simony was the sin of selling sacred offices or sacred things for money, and so he put some decrees in place which began to clean that up. But he also took the step of making celibacy mandatory. So it's now in the 11th century that celibacy finally becomes mandatory. People say, well, you mean you had married priests for the first millennium of the church? Well, yes and no. Celibacy had been gaining in popularity and had been gaining as a discipline in the church ever since the monastic movement had been moving through the church. But there was widespread concubinage, widespread marriage, and it was Leo the Ninth in the middle of this 11th century who finally put in place celibacy as a discipline, which was for the universal church, not just for the monks and not just for particular areas. What else did Leo do? Leo the Ninth set up the College of Cardinals. This is really important. Now, for the first time, it is the cardinals who are going to elect the pope. You see, one of the big problems about the papacy in the preceding two centuries was that nobody was really sure who should elect the pope, and that's why the Italian families struggled and for power and grasped for power and murdered one another, poisoned one another, deposed one another to try to grasp this great prize of the papacy, and why the kings were also involved in this process to see who they could put on the throne of Peter and who could therefore be their colleague, their ally in the power struggles. Well, Pope Leo the Ninth sets up the College of Cardinals, and the College of Cardinals is not what it is today, with several hundred cardinals all coming together to vote, or however many there are. Instead, it was only about seven or eight of the high priests or the senior clergy in Rome. Nevertheless, it was the senior clergy of Rome who were now going to appoint the pope, not just a mafia family or a king or a minor chieftain who was going to march in and put his man on the throne. So this is a very important transformation in the reformation of the papacy, that the church itself now is establishing its power and saying, we're going to choose the pope, not the king, not the mafia families, not the local chieftains, we are. Leo the Ninth was also very opposed to lay investiture. Lay investiture, as I've explained, was the custom of kings and noblemen appointing the bishops and the abbots and the priests, and therefore appointing their friends and appointing their allies into these very powerful and wealthy positions. And Leo the Ninth said, no, as part of the reform of the church, we're going to take control of those appointments. Not the king. Now, the irony of this is that King Henry III actually appointed these popes so that they might get on with reforming the church and cleaning up the church. But one of the things which they wanted to clean up was the practice that he enjoyed of appointing the bishops and the abbots. And so it kind of blew up in his face, and this is going to make for more of a conflict later. Leo then is succeeded by a couple of other popes who were not bad popes, but not really great popes. They continued the reform movement in their own way, Victor II, Stephen IX, and Alexander. And then in 1073 comes one of the great popes, one of the great reforming popes, and a great dramatic figure in the history of the papacy, and this is Gregory VII. Gregory VII had been following along these reform programs all the time, and he was finally acclaimed to be pope. And everyone rejoiced when he took the throne of Peter. He was one of the most dynamic and most energetic of all the popes. He rolled up his sleeves and got on with this reform movement in the church, and he also, in doing so, asserted papal power as it had never been asserted before. Now, this is really interesting to me, because you might remember that the popes had, from right back to Charlemagne, had assumed the power that they would crown the emperor, and the German kings would come to Rome, to St. Peter's, to be crowned as emperor, and the pope therefore had the power and the authority, had claimed the power and the authority to actually create the emperor and make the emperor. But Gregory VII takes this power one step further, and he actually says, not only does the pope have the power to make an emperor, he also has the power to depose an emperor and unmake an emperor, if you like. Well, by now, Henry III's son, Henry IV, is on the throne, and a great conflict arises between them. And we have to go into this a little bit, because it is actually important for the establishment of the papacy in the later years to see how this actually developed. The big problem was the lay investiture, and Gregory VII, like Leo the Ninth, was very intent on opposing the lay investiture, and making sure that the church controlled the appointments of abbacy of the to the monasteries to be abbots and to be bishops. And so in 1076, King Henry IV and Pope Gregory VII clash over the appointments of some bishops and some important posts in northern Italy. And the Pope threatens, therefore, to excommunicate Henry IV. And Henry IV responds furiously and says that the Pope is a false monk, and he threatens to depose the Pope. His father, you remember, had deposed three popes who were just the three popes who were on the throne at the same time. And so Henry IV says, well, I'm going to come and depose you. Unfortunately, the German noblemen were on the side of the Pope. And so they actually put pressure against Henry that he said, you can't depose the Pope. The Pope is God's anointed. And so Henry is forced to submit when the Pope is traveling north through the mountains to a conference in Germany. Henry IV is forced to go down and meet him at a place called Canossa in the mountains. And there's this dramatic scene where the Pope is inside the castle of one of his allies, one of his friends, and the king comes and stands barefoot in the snow for days, pleading for absolution and pleading for the Pope to accept his repentance and to forgive him for his rebellion. And so suddenly the Pope, Pope Gregory VII, has made this astounding victory in which he has been shown that his assertion of his power over the king has done the trick, and the king submits to him. Well, it would sound therefore like the Pope is on top in this power struggle, and he's going to reign supreme. However, the German nobles who had rebelled against Henry IV elected another king, a sort of anti-king, who was called Rudolf. And Pope Gregory makes the mistake of backing Rudolf against Henry IV. Rudolf then dies in battle, and Henry IV's power resurges, and he and Gregory clash again, and Gregory threatens to excommunicate him, and Henry again says, well, I'm going to depose you. And this time, Henry IV marches on Rome, and the Pope doesn't have enough power or enough resources to be able to turn away this German king with his army. And Henry IV marches on Rome, and he deposes Gregory and appoints Clement III as the Pope, who is his man in Rome. Well, the Normans had controlled southern Italy, and they came and rescued Pope Gregory from his refuge in the castle Sant'Angelo, which we spoke about before. Gregory had fled there and taken refuge, and some allies came and rescued him, and he died in exile a broken man. But the power that he had established and the universal authority of the Pope had been established once and for all. And we're going to see now that as part of the reformation of the papacy and part of the reformation of the church, the papacy grows in secular power, but most importantly, it has grown in spiritual power and authority. The reforming popes of the 11th century were not only interested in secular power, they were interested in retaining the rights of the church, and they were interested in retaining the power of the church in spiritual matters and being free from the secular powers. And Eamon Duffy, who is one of my main sources for this series, sums it up like this. Later on, after Gregory's death, Pope Urban II, who we'll come to later, articulated once more the aims of the reformed papacy that happened in the 11th century. He said that the church shall be Catholic, chaste, and free, Catholic in the faith and fellowship of the saints, chaste from all contagion of evil, and free from secular power. Because of Gregory, there would never again be another Charlemagne. No pope for 100 years, perhaps no pope ever, would loom so large on the European scene as he had done. So Gregory VII is a great monumental figure in the papacy, and he's the one we look to for as the great reformer in this 11th century. Not a perfect man, but a man who knew that the church's power had to be distinct and free from the secular power in order to assert the kingdom of God in the world. So for those of you who were struggling with me through the 2 centuries of the Dark Ages in the 9th and the 10th centuries that we've just been through, it's wonderful to see that now in the 11th century things have been turned around and the church is establishing its spiritual power on earth, free from the secular power and hopefully free from some of the attractions and the lust for wealth. We're going to see that that's going to continue to be a struggle, but I need to speak before we close this episode about a couple of other things that happened in this 11th century which are very monumental. One of them, of course, is the Great Schism between East and West. We will talk about this more in the next episode, but in 1054, the continuing trouble between the Eastern Church and the Western Church came to a climax, and the Patriarch and the Pope both excommunicated one another, and this is the formal date, therefore, for the Great Schism, the division between the Eastern Church and the West, which sadly even continues today. We looked at some of the roots of that in earlier episodes, and they had to do with the politics of the time, and they had to do with the claiming of land and claiming of territory, and that also had to do with the theology that and the discipline in the church, which the two churches disagreed on. So it's during this century, the 1054, that we see the two churches of East and West break into two and to be sadly to be separated and to drift into schism. The last thing that we need to just touch on is that it's at the end of this century that the First Crusade is actually launched in 1896, right at the end of the century. The First Crusade was an attempt to reclaim the Holy Land from the Muslim invaders who had taken it over. And the Pope called for this crusade so that the Christian armies could go into the Middle East and reclaim the land as a holy war. Again, this begins the period of the Crusades, and we'll talk about more about this in episode 13, in which we talk about the 12th century. So thank you for listening to Triumphs and Tragedies. I hope you've been enjoying the series so far. I think also I would just like to make a point about this whole series, and that is that the reason I'm doing this is because I'm aware that in our age we're lamentably sort of ignorant about history, and if we don't know the history of the church, we can sometimes get discouraged about the problems in the church and the struggles in the church. What strikes me about doing the research for these episodes is that in every age, there were plenty of people who were despairing about the corruption in the church, about the sin amongst the church leaders, amongst the theological corruption, the heresy, and the problems. And right from the very beginning, I think you've seen that we call this Triumphs and Tragedies because it's a constant conflict, a constant struggle between the forces of evil within the church, of sexual immorality and materialism and greed and pride and human failure on the one hand, and also a struggle with the secular powers, trying to get the balance between the things of this world and the things of the next, and also a struggle with the powers that would persecute the church. And so these three elements, the struggle with the corruption within, the struggle of persecution from without, and the struggle and the conflict between the church and the secular powers, is one which is still there today. And we see the church trying the best we can to proclaim the gospel of Jesus Christ and to build the kingdom of God in the world, and bumping into these problems of sexual immorality amongst our leaders, the child abuse scandals and the unfaithfulness and the greed and the corruption, as well as the struggles with the secular powers and the powers of this world that would we seek to take over the church. So I would encourage you to pray for our bishops, pray for the Pope, pray for the church, be faithful yourselves, and realize that this conflict is actually part of the struggle. It's what Jesus promised. He said it would happen this way. He said we would have to take up our cross. He said we would be persecuted. And right there at the very beginning, remember the apostles were not all absolutely perfect in their day. Peter denied the Lord and Judas betrayed him. And so this is part of being church. It's part of the Catholic history. It's part of our life as well, because in our lives as individuals, we struggle with these things. Don't you? I do. I struggle with greed. I struggle with lust. I struggle with the proper balance between my spiritual life and my secular life and the secular world around me. I struggle and have sometimes fear and doubt about the persecution of the church which might arise. And so we take all these things with faith and we move forward in faith, knowing that God is with his church and that the struggle is the beautiful struggle. It's the one which the Holy Spirit helps us to travel through so that we can emerge from the tragedies with the triumph of the cross. Thank you for listening. I'll remind you, please, to go over to my blog. You can always read my blog post day by day, listen to my podcast homilies. You can browse my books. Also, I've started a new podcast, which is over there. It's called Stories of the Unexpected. I encourage you to listen to it. It's just a short podcast in which I share true stories of the supernatural, of the miraculous, of the marvelous, things that I've experienced or my family has experienced, and also some stories from the lives of the saints. And I tell the story each time in each episode, and then I reflect on it a little bit so that we can learn about these wonderful things in our faith. So Stories of the Unexpected is my new podcast, and you can find that over at my blog. I encourage you to go and listen, to tune in, and support the blog if you can, because this podcast is free, but it's not free to produce, and the blog is free, but it's not free to produce, and it goes out to thousands of people around the world, and if you can help, if you have the means to help by being a donor, subscriber, then please do so. This has been Triumphs and Tragedies. I'm Father Dwight Longenecker. Thank you for listening.